Hallo und herzlich willkommen, lieber Hörer. Das ist dein Daily of the Month. Der Aachener Podcast über Zusammenarbeit für agile Organisationen.
Hello everyone. In today's episode we will be talking about talking to each other, open invitations, playing and staying in the moment, and of course building bridges from dilemma to banana. Welcome to the jungle!
Yeah, here we are with a new round of our beloved Daily of the Month podcast. And I can tell you there's a new player in town. Let's say hi to Amar Renato, or short, hello Amar, how are you doing?
Good evening. It's lovely to be here.
Great. Yeah. Great having you. Yeah, and not to forget my partner in crime and play, Andreas. Good evening to you as well, sir.
Yeah, good evening. I love that crime thing. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, guys, let's start. And let me begin with the elephant in the room, shall we? I think we need a little backstory from behind the Daily of the Month curtains. You know, all our episodes, we have a first preparation call with our guests. And this is mainly for us to focus on the topic and to find a main thread for the episode, or the roten Faden, as we say in German, a leading question that will guide us through the episode and that we want to answer with our guests during the dialogue. And so guess what Amar did? Yes, right. He played dirty, I can tell you, with his proposal. Real dirty. Amar, do you remember the proposal you served us?
I said trust. I said no questions. Yes, let's be agile.
That's right. This guy said, and I quote, "What happens when we don't have a thread for the dialogue?" And my inner voice was like, "What the fuck? What the deuce?" I think it's "what the deuce." And my outer voice was like, "Ah, oh, yeah, why not? Come on." And my inner voice then responded things that I can't state right now because I can't do that on broadcast. But we agreed we will do it today as an open jam down in the pub. There's no conductor, there's no theme, there's no horizon in sight. It's just three cheeky monkeys armed with microphones and 1 hour of recording time.
Yeah.
Honestly, calm is not exactly my current state of being right now, but I'm working on it. Yeah, this said, I'll take some time now to cool down and have a little cold sip of my beverage post.
Enjoy. And maybe I can take over, yeah. So
yeah, you will. Here's a banana dressed like a microphone.
Thank you. Oh, he's throwing bananas at me now. Amar, I would like to hear about the song you chose. Why is it? And has it a connection to you? Is there something special about it?
So this song by Peter Gabriel, Come Talk to Me. I find Peter Gabriel a very contemplative person, a person that really reflects on life. And it comes into his music. And when I was a monk a long time ago, a Buddhist monk, somebody gave me this track to listen to, and I never forgot. I never forgot this music. And actually, I ran a 8-week course on this album, just on this music. Each week we would listen to a track. But this idea of "Come Talk to Me." There's something about we all want to be listened to. We all want to be witnessed. We want to be received in life. So you can receive the song in two ways. You can receive it as in please come talk to me, you know, meet, you know, or that wanting, that desire in ourselves to really speak to somebody and know that you're going to be heard, know that you're going to be fully received. And in the current profession I am, as a coach, as a coaching supervisor, that's what I'm doing all day long. And there's something beautiful about that way of connecting to another human being. I mean, we don't need to do it in that relationship. We can do it in the supermarket, you know, with our friends and family. How do we receive one another? How do we be fully present? You know, we just talked about, you know, so if there's no, you know, if there's no question, what do we do? But that's fertile ground for me. Come talk to me.
Yeah, it's an invitation, isn't it?
It's an invitation, yeah. And do you take the invitation? Do you receive it? And what do you do? What do you do with it? You know, do you have to throw it away immediately? Sometimes.
And you never come around with an idea, an exact forecast of what it is that is being talked about. I mean, it's an open invitation. You never know.
You never know. You never know. I never know from 1 minute to the next, from one client to the next, from 1 week to the next, or one moment to the next, exactly what's going to come out. But how can one prepare oneself for that?
Yeah, you can also connect this to our last episode where we talked about improv theater and all that. So you never know what's going to happen there.
No. And what in life do we really know?
Oh, very, very philosophical.
Yeah. What is it that we can really trust?
We already jumped into your philosophy and your professional life. Great.
I can't help. You know, that's how it is, isn't it? We're so intertwined. You know, for myself, when I, you know, reflect on who I am, you know, you bring a load of things with you from what you've done past, and then how do you bring that into what you do now without making it all of your life? You know, that's past is important, you know, childhood, teenage years, well, you know, all those times. But so this, yeah, I was just going to say, so this willingness to, you know, to be present, to be open to what goes on, allows for all of that, doesn't it? Allows that invitation. I would encourage also the people listening to come into the invitation here. To be with us right now. How is this? When I was a monk, we were trained to give talks, but only by reflection, not by dogma. So we were asked not to prepare, but just speak from the present moment. So I sort of, you know, so there's some practice with that, but there's also an encouragement about how to listen to this podcast. So it's not about, like, for this one anyway, you know, not to receive it as fact, but as reflection. So how does it affect you when you, me, us say something? What does it do? So that one can use it for understanding yourself better, not just getting facts, which are also, of course, they're helpful, but to understand yourself more fully.
And when you were first opposed with this task of giving a talk with no plan, structure whatsoever in beforehand, did this come by nature to you, or was it a process of acquiring or learning on how to do that? Because for me, I can say I'm working as a Scrum Master. You should think that should come very easy to me, but also for me it's training, it's really challenging after all. How did you feel when you first came into these situations, and what helped you find your way?
Well, before you do that, you listen to a lot of other talks by monks and nuns in the monastery. So you know, and if you're willing to have this reflective attitude, you start to let it sit with you, like, how do they start? And you get a feeling around it, and then you get a tone, and then you start to make up your own way of what you might do and how you might do that. And I think in a way this is about apprenticeship. We've lost that little bit, but I think in Scrum and Agile you get that a little bit. You know, how do you become an apprentice? Well, what apprentice is all about tacit knowledge. It's all about you watch something and it gets absorbed into you, and then you say something about it externally, and then it becomes more explicit. So I watched a lot of the monks. I watched the abbot of the, who was a very good talker, and I watched how he did it. And then also we were encouraged to live from the present moment, so everything was around that. And then when I had to run these big family camps, there was about 100 people on them, and actually I worked with a German nun, and she was very prescribed in her approach, right? So everything had to be detailed. And I'm chaotic in my nature. So it was a great compliment. We actually really worked well, and we did plan everything. But we both had an agreement that at the start of the camp, that plan was just a plan. That's it. And if it needed to change, the weather changed. We had a walk based on a Thursday. It rained. You can't go on a Thursday. It was, you know, it's too wet. So you have to change it. So, you know, this. So you learn to adapt. You learn to adapt fast and quick and continuously. And so all of that came into the talks in a way. You know, it's not to say I wasn't nervous, it's, you know, but you learn how to do it.
So when you talked about supervision and come talk to me as an invitation to maybe such a thing, so you open the space and hold a space for someone speaking to you, talking about whatever it is that is in the moment important.
Yeah. It's not for me to prescribe or tell them or say what to, you know, what to bring, but it's that openness. It's that reflection and collaboration together, that learning process. I actually like super dash vision, which is supervision. How clearly can you see what's going on, both with your client, with yourself, and with the system? So you get more, and that is all relational, and bringing it into a relationship with somebody external can really help to bring that clarity and see what's going on.
When you are doing that, then the invitation gets accepted. What happens after that? What happens in such a supervision coaching conversation?
Well, it's so interesting, because actually you don't know again, right? So you have to be with the not knowing. And sometimes, you know, it's a very straightforward thing. The coach, you know, has had a struggle and they didn't know what to do with it. It's overwhelmed them and they want to debrief and work it out. Sometimes it's a, you know, an ethical problem. Yeah, sometimes it's a management problem. Sometimes it's a personal problem. Sometimes it's a systemic problem. You know, can you see, if you just had to write down a checklist and then tick it off and then say, in this situation, do this, you'd have a book so thick. Do you know what I mean? The book, it's just not possible to have answers. But in this willingness to explore, you know, there are supervision models, you know, and I learned them through in my accreditation, but it's really this willingness just to walk together. I like that. Walk together on this journey and say, oh, look, that tree's down there. Why is that tree down there? Or why did that person react in that way? You know, and by doing that, the coach can get really good insight into what that is. Why is that? Why did that happen? And sometimes, of course, I share my own knowledge. That's part of it, you know, some through experience. But really, it's mainly about helping the coaches come back to their own resources and see for themselves. Oh yeah, you know. But I notice also when I have coaching supervision as a supervisor, you know, and there's areas sometimes I don't know, and I've got a very experienced supervisor. And I just say, so what would you do in this situation? And oh, well, you know, it's interesting, the word competency, you know, we have coaching competency, but the word competency, it actually means to do it together. It's not one person doesn't develop a competency. Mm-hmm. So it's how do you develop your skill together with somebody? And that's mutual. That's not just the coach. It's the coach and the supervisor develop together in an agreement. And that space allows the agreement. Come talk to me is actually, that's the agreement.
Mm-hmm. And what would be something that is still struggling you when you are on a supervision challenge or supervision mission.
Not really.
And what is the dash part? You have to explain to me what is the dash part.
I don't understand. I guess because a lot of people think that supervision is somebody standing behind you and telling you what to do, because that's the usually how you hear it. Okay. Super dash vision is really much more clarity. Yeah, that you've got super clarity about what's going on, both for yourself and in the system. So yeah, there's sometimes there's just really complicated ethical decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, I need to think through it. I don't want to speak specifics because sometimes they're really tricky. But it's usually around some type of boundary that's been broken. Yeah, and then that in that boundary breaking, there's a conflict, and with that conflict, leads to a big mess, fallout, and then how do you resolve, repair, and start again with that? And sometimes
a dilemma, maybe
a dilemma. Like yeah. I mean, in a sort of agile environment, it would be something around manager not knowing about agile, you know, and then the conflict that the agile coach has with that. Where do they take that? You know, and then it can get really messy because maybe the agile leader is also the product owner, or, you know, and then you've got all sorts of different boundaries in that.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you resolve those? You know, do you just go and talk to your mate Bob up the road, like that, or do you take it to somebody? You take it outside of the system so you can get perspective. You know,
so
and
then
when I don't understand it, of course, then I have to say, well, I don't understand it. It's rare though that happens. It's because I'm also reflecting on it in the session, and then if it's something complicated, you know, and it goes over a few sessions, we have time to, you know, I have time also to go through it in my own mind and come to a resolve. But a lot of the time, it's around being able to be silent.
So what I'm hearing is that you are helping to overcome biases and share a view.
Yeah, you can't get rid of biases, as you know. The human condition is like that. But what you can do, you know, like they have these fantastic maps of biases, you know, 100, you know, I don't know, there's the loads of them, maybe 50, 60. Imagine trying to remember every condition that goes with a bias. Mm-hmm. You can reduce them. And then what you want to do is be able to know that you are being biased. And then being able to step away from that. And a mindfulness practice is great for reducing biases because you can see how you're operating. You can see the thinking process behind it. And so biases is a big one, you know. How do I see myself? You know, how do I see the other person? You know, and especially if you feel biased towards a team member, you know, they shouldn't be like this, or they're like that, or their culture is like this. And that stops you come talk to me, you know, that stops you listening to what the person's actually saying, because you're hearing it through a filter of it shouldn't be like this, or they should be like that, or something else, you know. And that's actually the trigger warning. When you get that, then that's the one to say, okay, something's not quite right. And that's what I do myself as a coaching supervisor. If I'm ever triggered really strongly in a session, and then that's the one that I would also take to my coaching supervisor.
Let's repeat that trigger. I think that's a really worthwhile information. So what is the trigger that you are aware of?
It's one where you normally feel, if you feel really overwhelmed, overwhelmed, and you really don't know what to do. There's a don't know, which you can be really comfortable with. And you know,
strong emotions, something like that.
Not even strong emotion. I can be with intense, very, very strong emotions. But there's a sense of like in trauma work, it's called vicarious trauma. It's like what you get when you listen to other people, you know, and it's basically too much for you, and you think that you can deal with it, and then if it starts affecting your sleep, your personal life, all those types of things, that's the one. And usually, what we do is we override them. We don't listen to them. Right, so we just carry on, and that creates a stress upon a stress.
Okay. So what would be a good path to go if I have this trigger and when I'm realizing that kind of trigger?
Well, it is, in some ways, it is to have somebody else to talk it through with, so that you can really get perspective on it. If you've got a, some sort of mindfulness practice or a body awareness practice or something like that, where you can get perspective, you can observe your mind, your body, your heart, and you're really able to step back without being detached. So there's and really see what's going on. Then you can deal with a lot, you know. I mean, but you need, that is a training in itself to be able to step back.
So it's a cleanup of your emotions, something you can work through in conflict, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you like, it's not that you get rid of your emotions or you become sort of like neutralized. You don't become a zombie. Actually, you become much more sensitive and aware of all the different emotions. Brené Brown, the social researcher, she says something so beautiful. She says, if you ignore one emotion, you ignore them all. I'll say that again. If you ignore one emotion, you ignore them all. That's so powerful. So powerful. So how can you embrace all your emotions and not react, but respond to them?
I think if you're talking about Brené Brown, that's that really triggers me, because I like many things that she presented to the world. I think that's really a fine mind, I would say. And I remember when she talks about resilience and how to act on stressful situations when your emotions are on in the hijack mode, as we described it in our episode on emotions at work. She has this guiding of saying, stop communication for a while.
Yes.
Stop with every communication for a while, reconsider, and then when you sort it through, come back and act. But pause yeah. for a minute. And take a turn.
Yeah. So in emotional intelligence, that, and this is what they teach to children, is the 6-second rule, because it takes 6 seconds after amygdala hijack to get the chemicals out your brain. And so, you know, this grandmother sayings, you know, little Johnny, just count to 8, and then, you know, but actually there's a lot of science behind this, which is basically if you keep your mouth shut, count to 8, let the chemical come out your brain, you've got a much better chance of not causing a mess to yourself or anybody else. I remember once I had it when I was a monk. I caught myself. I was at a train station, and the ticket, something happened at the ticket office, and I just went into this amygdala hijack. I was roaring at the guy, and then I just caught myself, and it was just like, there you go, you see, there it is. And then just step back, pause, let the chemical drain, and then carry on, really. But it is this pause practice is so important, you know. Important.
So when you're having that supervision conversation, is this with the aim of having a success? What is success of such a conversation?
So doesn't really, it's interesting, the word doesn't even resonate with me in that context. It's so interesting. It's like, hold on, like I've got to do this scan of words. And that doesn't fit in this space. See, success means that there's been a failure, right? And something went wrong. And I don't see supervision really as that. I see supervision as a learning space, a collaborative learning space. So it's like, how do you take what you've learned, you know, what's not gone right, and learn from it? And so then that for me would be a sort of success. Yeah.
The learning.
The learning, yeah. Not the success in itself. But the great thing about supervision is it's also there for celebration. It's not there just for bringing the wrong things. It's because coaching is a lonely business. So nobody gives you a pat on the back generally. So, you know, so if you bring it to coaching supervision, it's another way of being able to share those successes.
Yeah. But I guess that your clients will come with some kind of expectation why they try to win you as a coach. So they see some kind of outcome for themselves, maybe. With what expectation do they come to you? And I guess that would be maybe also a definition of some kind of success. I'm reaching some kind of goal for myself.
Yeah, that's a better way of describing it in a way. And I would say most of the coaches that come to me for supervision are looking for some sort of like personal growth, personal and professional development. They want to expand, and it depends where you are as a coach. And in the coaching world, there's also maturity, different levels of maturity which have been sort of worked out. So, you know, it starts off with sort of a model approach, then a philosophical approach, and then David Clutter, Professor David Clutterbuck, says that, you know, maturity. And those coaches that do the best, they call it systemic eclectic. So what that means is that you can just be with any situation. You've got tons of knowledge. You know, you know lots of models, but your ability to synthesize them and not even talk about them. Mm-hmm. But bringing them into the way that you coach and be able to be fluid with them. So depending on what a coach, you know, where a coach is, I can help them, you know, expand that. But it's usually that. And then some coaches come because there's been a difficult situation, and they don't know what to do. You know, there's been some personal struggle, and that's not dependent on years either. That can be, I work with very experienced coaches, you know, just as beginners, and it can happen.
What I really enjoy when I'm with a coaching engagement, a scrum master or agile coach, is to have someone to talk to. It might be over coffee, it might be walking a piece of music, enjoy together, something like that, easy. But it also helps me to calm down and get some insights. It's part of my what I would call self-management, but not in the strict way. It is in the getting loose way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To become neutral, even if possible, playful again.
Yeah.
Because for me, agile is a lot of playing around, experimenting, and not always it is needed to have a success in the sense of reaching a goal. It could be a learning, as
that's
we
right.
mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And if you say playful, I just had a recent interview with an expert on playfulness. I talked with my daughters on a little trip to the forest yesterday. And so I asked them, so what do you think makes up a good game, a good play? And so one of the first things they said to me was that it makes fun.
Yes.
So Emma, how can we make it fun to be coached? Because this seems like a teacher's more dry situation, but how can we make it fun? Or is it even a desired state for your kind of coaching? I don't know.
So I think the research, interestingly, agrees with your daughter.
It does.
Of course, funny enough.
And this way, it's like that. It's not the other way around.
No, and exactly. And play. You know, the research on play says it's the best place to learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best place to learn. Why is it the best place to learn? Because it's relational. Yeah, when we're relational, it's fun. When we're together with other people, we are hardwired for other people. Now, I know we struggle and we have conflict and all the rest of it, but our peak moments usually are with other people, you know, and the oldest form of technology is sitting around the campfire eating. Why is restaurants so popular?
Mm.
It's a group activity. We're wired for that type of thing. So for me, play is about attention. How do you attend to something? If you look at the way your daughter plays, she's fully attending to what's going on. and she's having a tremendous amount of fun. Oh, here's my foot again, or, you know, here's my hand, or here's a new branch, or here's a tree, or whatever it is, a new game. So watching children is a fantastic way to see that. And all our emotional intelligence is learnt by play. And when we don't have that, when we don't have free play in our childhood, that's when we struggle with emotions. Actually, you don't need all this emotional intelligence when you're older. If we allowed kids to free play, it wouldn't happen, because you'd learn how to regulate your emotions as a kid with other kids.
So you would say then that we should relearn playfulness,
yes,
or let it loose, accept this vulnerability as well,
yes,
as it is in a play. It is, the outcome is not certain. You just enjoy your time together, and it might be without a specific goal. It's,
yes,
just enjoying time.
Yes, indeed. And it requires also boundaries, like all playgrounds do.
Mm-hmm.
So again,
some rules, something.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's where you can create that sense of safety.
Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, a play doesn't necessarily need some kind of, this is what we want to reach by playing, right? And if you have group situations or in a Scrum context, thinking of a retrospective or something like that, you hear a lot of times is, why are we doing this? Do we really? And what is the outcome? And when my kids start playing, they don't ask this question. They just go with the flow.
Yeah.
So something, we lose something on the way. Why is that? And how might we regain that?
It's very dangerous to become an adult. I don't recommend it. because it creates, keeps us fixed, you know, that's what, isn't it? So children don't do that. So I would say you need an adult and a child, you need both. So how do you reconnect to that sense of curiosity and vulnerability and play, and also respect and be kindful for those that find it also difficult, because play can be very challenging, you know. So it's like, how do you keep it gentle and soft and kind, you know, so that people can feel that they can fall into it. When I ran teenage retreats, everything was optional,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
There was guidelines, very clear guidelines, but everything was optional. And one time a young kid came, and I never saw him for the whole weekend. I think I saw him twice. And I said to him at the end, you know, just tell us, what did you learn? He said, oh, it was great. I needed a quiet place to do my homework.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that's served its purpose, you know.
What's interesting about what you're saying is when I'm planning for a workshop about maybe lean agile ways of working or something, it's always a place that people remember even after years.
Yes.
When we are playing with Lego, when we are playing with paper balls,
right,
or whatever it is, planes, ships. I use physical things, and I like it really, even maybe in electronic video conferencing setting.
Yeah.
Plays is that what opens up and transports the message better than any PowerPoints or whatever we can share, videos or something.
Why do you think that is, Andreas?
Yeah, it is, because it opens up. People focus more on the fun of it. And in a play, I don't have to explain the outcome beforehand. People tend to just jump into it and experience the situation.
My sense for it is it's an embodied experience again. So we bring our bodies along, and learning is body. Learning is in the body. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how can you get, because I really experience this quite some time, that there's a kind of a resistance to free play when you're working with adults.
Yes.
It's a dangerous thing for some people. And how can you bring them back to the playfulness? So what are ways of calming them down, open them up for a playful workshop?
You can't do it. Nobody can force anybody else what to do. All you can do is set the conditions of which enable people to maybe come in or not. And that requires a high degree of psychological safety.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I worked a lot, you know, with the family camp, you know, I worked a lot in creating that psychological safety and getting people prepared, both personally and in the group, to be able to deal with that high level of creativity. Mm-hmm. And then and once that came about, then actually they demanded it. So the parents got fed up with bringing their kids to the teenage retreat and looking and noticing all the kids were having great fun and they weren't. So they said, mm-hmm. put on the same retreat for us. Right? Mm. And that also, you know, it's the same thing when I run a workshop online. You know, so it's not to force people to play. I mean, it's to allow them to slowly see how it is for them. Just like what Andrea said, you know, a few bits of Lego and a plane and a thing, and people start talking, and then they start speaking, and then you know you're off on something. And is it? Can you be with that uncertainty as the facilitator or the coach or whatever it is? Can you hold that space of like? Don't know, and hold it safely, not just hold it so it can, you know, because it can also be incredibly destructive. Mm-hmm. And those forces are very close together. Mm-hmm. You know, in psychology, it's also being with what's called the liminal space, this very clear not knowing space. It's transformational. But in order to be with that, you have to be out, you know, as a facilitator, you have to be outside of it. I once did in Amsterdam, I offered a workshop for all the coaches in a big management school, and we explored this liminal space, you know. And when we were designing the workshop, the person that brought me on board said, so what's going to be the result, you know, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know.
And then what happened?
And then I got the gig, I got the job, and we had a lot of fun, you know. I use all sorts of different mediums, you know, videos and all sorts of different ways of being able to engage people in it, music, and you know, I've done dance, talk, Lego, you know, I've used lots of different formats, you know, and you have to see what a group can, you know, can tolerate as well, mm-hmm. you know. And luckily enough, you know, I started off in the computer business, so you know, I have a background as a geek, so I sort of know from inside out, you know, whether my inner IT person would like the exercise or not, you know, when I'm working for a tech firm or. You know, or in education, or you know, all the different areas I work in. You know, you have to be also respectful of what you know can be done. But also, the other thing as well is, you know, my brand, Playful Monk, is sort of a filter in a way. Like, if you know, like, would you come to a brand called Playful Monk like to not play? I mean, it's sort of help. Do you know what I mean? I'm not come here for play. I've come here for. You know, I've come here for whatever, but two things go together, you know. So play, yeah, which is this what we're talking about now, and then monk is that growth mindset, is the mindset that holds the play. So they go together, they're opposites and also mutually supportive, really. So it is, you know, there's probably quite a few situations where it wouldn't be welcome, but then that's fine as well. There's somebody else that can offer into that space. I'm not saying it's for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
It helps to relieve stress. That is my experience.
Oh, yes.
With teams. And if a team is able to relieve stress by playing together, it is marvelous, because any situation can be resolved after. Yes. Having a conflict or a stressful moment.
Exactly. And that once people just get familiar with that language, that they know that they can actually do the play, like, then it's mm-hmm. easy. It's just, mm-hmm. it's actually like, let's just get the box out or the cards, or let's just stop and, you know, and also just to have as a scrum master or an agile coach, to have that ability to stop it and just say, well, let's just do this. Mm-hmm. How would this be, you know? most people think, oh, great, you know.
And did you also experience, when you were in the role of a participant, a surprising game on one occasion that might even challenge you a bit, or was a very pleasant experience? Most favorite play experience as an adult, let's put it like this.
Oh, actually the one that I had the most fun with, and also the one that got completely out of hand, was I saw this I think it was in London, it was an art exhibition where an artist created a village, a whole city out of cardboard boxes, right? And you build it. So I did this at one event, and it was so fantastic to build it. And you see people's creativity, because they built everything, supermarkets, sewage. Mm-hmm. The whole room was just filled. I had tons of cardboard and sellotape. It was just so much fun. But then it got completely out of hand, because some people were up all night. You know, they hadn't slept. They were just like, I've got to do this and I've got to put this. And then we actually had a conflict between two towns in the end. It was really interesting.
Okay,
so as a facilitator, that was like, whoa. You know, you think with a simple thing. So that was quite a challenge.
Talking boundaries, right?
Yes, again. Yeah, do you see how
a need for that?
Yeah, there was. I was really taken aback by it, because it like, for me to recall it even now, that's a, you think, oh wow.
Yeah, you're smiling.
Yeah. I am. I remember the fun of it. I remember it was just fantastic. Fun.
Yeah, even in my preparation, I mean, you filled my head with like this playfulness and play thought. And I looked up the things about playing, and there's like an own discipline on playing ludology or something. And rules is like the second most important structural element of a play. You need rules. And this is also something that you learn as a child if you play. That why do you need rules? Because the play won't work without the rules. Or if you bend the rules, then you're the cheater, and you learn to accept rules and go to the boundaries, etc. pp. I think it's really good experience.
Yeah, and that's actually what the life of a monk is about, exploring rules. Most of us have no idea actually how to use rules. So I learned how to explore rules being gray rather than black. Most of us expect rules to be black and white. And then that's what we do with ethics and morality. But these are living things. They're a living concepts. You know, as a monk, I had tons and tons of rules. But I learned how to use them, not manipulate them, not from self-service, but actually how to use them. And that gives you so much freedom. And then, you know, you have the container of playing around with those rules. So we had one where, you know, one of the rules, no drinking. So you can't drink, no singing, no dancing, no sex, no rock and roll. You know, they're very tight rules. But in that tightness, actually, you learn a lot about yourself. It's not to say I don't need those rules now, although I still don't drink, but that's out of choice. It is about seeing that. And then the other thing, which is, I think, very important within the agile world as well, is, of course, that you negotiate the rules. You co-create them with the group.
You change them sometimes.
Yes, and you change them, exactly. And how do you set those rules with the group so that they can take it on board for themselves? What might they need to add? You know, and then, of course, you've got ownership. And once you've got ownership, you know, you've got responsibility. And then that can lead to vulnerability and authenticity and all these things, really.
Yeah.
That's really good.
What I really like about what you're saying is this experience of being able to change rules, to just come together, discuss,
right,
maybe in a retro or some other occasion.
Yes.
Change the rules and then see what happens.
Yes.
By a new constraint.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And you can, exactly. And who's to say you can't do that? Mm-hmm. You see, we assume, oh, well, we can't do that because those are the rules. But that's not true. We can co-create whatever we see fit in that particular situation with those constraints, you know, whatever they are, whatever the product owner says and all of that. But you can do a lot, though, because if you think of a complex system, one little change in one of those little guiding numbers, and the whole thing goes completely off, or it becomes an attractor. So experimentation, you know, is really important.
And you can encourage people to challenge the rules.
Yes. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
That's a fun part. That's a crime I'm doing.
I like it. Yeah. Why not? You know, just see where that takes you. You know, teenagers are fantastic for that.
For me, my North Star is simply a smile. If I see people smiling, I say, okay, go there.
I like it. That's simple.
Yeah, but so if we're talking like the general people, I think it's dangerous to say it like this, but rules, they give you a kind of stability, and like changing parts of these rules really is stressful, and you have to learn to deal with these changes. And this, I think, a very, very important training part that we also have to work on as Scrum Masters or Agile coaches. And
as a planet,
that you have to do in little dosage, I think. So don't be too swift on the first time, and finding these right little steps, like Esther Derby, she talked about change or change management with us, and talked about putting these big audacious goals into these little steps and rechecking each step at a time. So doing things one step at a time. That's the tricky part, I think.
Yeah.
Finding these steps.
How do you do that, Andreas?
Playful and using, as I said, the smile and the feedback you get by your smile as my guidance, and see, is it too challenging for the moment?
Yeah.
Or can I encourage someone to take a further step, or just pause for the moment, reflect on what has been experienced? So yeah, the limit is always how people trust each other and collaborate, and our aim is to deliver value to customers.
Yeah.
So if we are endangering, for instance, the delivery of something and have great fun, well, for the moment it might be okay, but on the long run it will not. So I have to be then a little bit more strict as a Scrum Master and refocus maybe on the delivery side of it. But the other thing is also true. If you're only focusing on delivery and not doing it playful and with inspiring ideas, challenging the tradition, the hierarchy, or whatever it is, then it might be resulting in a feature factory. Something that has been done 100 times will be done another 500 times,
right?
And that is not what we are aiming for.
No,
we want to find better ways to do things.
Exactly.
And I think if you feel too comfortable in every retrospective, then there's also something fishy going around.
Right.
This feeling of awkwardness. So like, again, Brené Brown, yeah? It's really a trigger signal for things are changing and there's something to learn here. I think that's a really strong feeling that you can transvert into really good energy to work on yourself, because that's mostly the sign for things are reprogramming inside your head.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I wonder what your daughter would say about this, Chris. What would she say?
Leave me alone. I want to watch a series.
That's it. Exactly. Exactly. And then, so what do you do with that? Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it. What do you do with that when that comes up, you see?
Yeah, you sometimes have to rattle the cage and say, come on, let's play a little bit. And and then you are in the role of the chaos monkey and intervene from the outside with something sudden.
Yeah.
Which jumps to your mind.
Yeah. Or you go and play by yourself and see if the child comes towards you.
Could be a challenge, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the feces rowing starts. Okay. I was saying before I would not tell the non-PC stuff in the recording, but I think I learned something now.
So what I'm aiming for when I'm working with teams is first of all, reflect on the culture of avoiding any mistakes, coming to go for the learning in it. And then the next step would be, okay, if we could learn something, can we just invent something right now? And at that place, that is a sweet spot I would like to see the team. I hope for a good mood, good vibes between the team. Collaboration is a result inevitably. They have fun, they want to do something together, and then this ignites ideas and something new springs out of it.
Yeah, indeed.
That's what I'm going for.
Yeah, and also play is about conflict. Play doesn't have to be all fun.
Yeah, that's true.
It has to include all the parts of it. As long as, you know, because, yeah, we think, oh, yeah, it's like I'm part of another project. I'm advising on a project around play. And I said, you know, I'm pretty serious about play. I think they thought, oh, I was just going to come along and it'll all be like really funny and laughing. But actually, it's also a serious thing. If you're going to think about boundaries and creating psychological safety, and you're going to allow all the emotions, all the different things in, which can be fun, you know, because you can amplify them. But in the beginning, it can also be quite a struggle for, you know, for that. And then also when you do bring it all together and then you do have that conflict, yeah, how can you look after that space?
Yeah.
You know, because it's bound to come up. When you're doing play, it's bound to come up because somebody's going to say, I don't want to play on the swing, you know?
I completely agree. There's ambition in it and competition between teams on something. Yeah,
yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
fire them up.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. In a kind way, you know. And sometimes competition is good. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's better to cooperate, you know. But it is this playfulness along with the ability to reflect, you know, and also, you know, it does require some personal development sometimes. It requires not just the team to grow, but also each person to grow in it. And sometimes that requires that person goes and get extra support from somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And that's also valid. And a team can only go as fast as the person with the least amount of development, if it's going to be safe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know,
if they won't leave someone behind them. It triggers curiosity. That is something I really like. If they are questioning themselves and past.
Yeah. And you know, and in some cultures that's not promoted. You know, and then you have the cultural things. But I think as human beings, we are curious. Our fundamental nature is curious, because I think that's what kept us going so long on the planet, you know. Mm-hmm. but, you know, and also led us into the, you know, the way that, you know, what we're doing with the climate now. I mean, we talked about adaptability and change and, you know, fixed rules, you know, and this time of the pandemic, which we're exploring now, you know, this is what everybody's struggling with, actually, how to keep being flexible, how to keep being adaptive, because things are changing so quickly all the time. And it's interesting, it has come at this time. You know.
So we're now talking for quite some time about playing, and we still are talking about playing. Guys, I want to play now.
You planned something, come on.
No, I didn't. I kept the word. I was true to the challenge. There's no plan ahead, I promise.
Okay.
So we have to come up with something. So let's play.
I've got a game. So it's quite well, it may not work, because we'll just try it.
Yeah.
We
can crash and burn together. No problem. I'm with you.
actually, no. Okay, we'll just do it for fun, which is so we need to okay, I just realized the game requires more people, but I was just thinking we could try it. We've got to count to 6. Mm-hmm. Yeah, normally you do this game, you just do it once. Yeah, and you count to the number of the people in the group. But because we're a small group, but there's 3 of us, we're going to count to 6. And if we say and number three times we're out. So each of us should be able to say a number twice, yeah, to get round to six. Okay, you get that? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So somebody has to start, and the idea is to get to six.
Okay. One.
Two.
Three.
Four.
Five.
Six. So we are coaches.
Indeed. Indeed. That's, you see, and that says it actually a lot about play and coaching, you see, because we actually each gave ourselves permission and time to answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it sharpens our listening skills and reacting to what the others do.
Well, we all looked at each other. Listeners can't see this, but we actually were looking at each other when we were doing that, you see.
Yeah.
Maybe there was some nodding or something.
Yes. Yeah.
And Andreas, I just, because you just posted this little link just yesterday about improv games, I remember one. And I didn't plan, but just I have it on the tip of my head now. Mm-hmm. It was like someone starts with a question and the other one has to go on with another question.
Oh, yeah, that's a
answer
good game.
Answer a question with a question.
Yeah.
And we can just make it round robin style.
Let's do that.
Okay, Andreas, why are you hanging in the trees?
Chris, why is that important?
How do you feel about that story, Emma?
Andreas, how many dogs have you got in your house?
What options have you considered when you asked that question?
Who's that to?
Emma.
What color is that?
When I hear your question, I'm suddenly asking myself what the listener might think right now. What do you think is it, Andreas?
It would be a kind of what would you like to have happen, Chris, at this moment, I think.
And more importantly, what will be the good end point of this game?
How many endings can there be?
What will you be seeing or hearing lets you know it is an end.
And why did Bon Jovi call that album Slippery When Wet?
Is that a stop sign?
And what would have to be true for this option to look fantastic, this being a stop sign?
And what happens when we don't have a threat for the dialogue?
And what stops it to being resolved already?
How long can we go before we bore ourselves?
Or the listeners. So yes, I really like that.
Thank you, Chris. That was good.
Okay, we can reflect afterwards what we might have learned by that.
I would like to reflect on what kind of gin tonic I would prefer right now.
Okay. I have a suggestion for you from the Rhineland, the Siegfried gin. Yeah. I won't have a zip, but it smells fantastic. Really. Yeah.
So
okay.
What we have to recognize, everyone is smiling right now, brightly.
Okay. Yeah. If this isn't an outcome, I don't know what is.
So. Yeah.
All good. But you see, I look at the clock. Time is ticking away. That damn old bastard time, but Andreas has something on his sleeve.
One last question. We have a routine here, and that is the last question, which is there anything important unsaid, Amma?
Yeah. That's the thing that was unsaid. The silence.
Oh, nice.
I love that. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Yeah. Really, really fun. Just goes to show what happens when you're just willing to be with each other. You know, this come talk to me. I mean, it's totally doable and enjoyable.
Absolutely.
And relaxing and easy.
And things emerge that should be emergent at the moment.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. And maybe if we can give space to that, we can also give space to a better planet, because we can allow that in. More kindness and compassion and well-being all around.
Yeah. Relax. Enjoy. Yeah.
sounds like a plan. And maybe we can also talk about our plan for the next episode. Maybe we change it. I don't know. We are those freaky, cheeky, agile monkeys here, hanging loose in the trees in the wild, wild jungle. Yeah, I wanted to tell something about the next episode and the next guest before we say bye-bye to our current guest. We'll be talking with Patricia Graf. She's a designer and entrepreneur. And she does fantastic jobs in the field of guerrilla marketing and has really an incredible talent for bringing diverse groups and individuals together and inspire them for great things to do. And I'm not exactly sure what we will be talking about with her. We have some ideas, but we shouldn't have too much planning ahead like today. So let's see about that. We're really looking forward. And thank you very much, Amar.
Pleasure. Real pleasure.
Pleasure was on my side. And thank you for being such a great, lovely co-host, Andreas.
Yeah,
and I say,
thank you.
It's a wrap.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Yeah, and here's just a little pause. No one knows why, but it is here.
It's part of the concept. Come on.